You're listening to an interview with Jesse Rosenfeld at CKUT. I'm Niusha Bastani, and I'll be hosting this interview. Jesse Rosenfeld is a Canadian journalist based in the Middle East since 2007. His work has been published with The Nation, The Guardian, Al Jazeera English, Le Monde Diplomatique, Electric Intifada, and The Daily Beast, among others. He is the focus of Santiago Bertolino's latest documentary film, Freelancer on the Frontlines, which follows his journey as he covers the Egyptian Revolution, the 2014 Gaza War, the reality of refugee camps in Turkey, and the progress of Kurdish fighters against Daesh. Freelancer on the Frontlines is featured in the Montreal International Documentary Festival this year. I wanted to ask you about the time you've spent reporting in Israel and occupied Palestine. So there's a really striking scene in the movie where you're driving on the apartheid road. I'm wondering if you could talk about this jarring inequality that's encompassed in the apartheid road, the apartheid wall, that I think really comes out in your coverage of the 2014 Gaza War in the movie.
So yeah, I'd been based in Israel-Palestine since 2007. I lived primarily in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Lived for a while in Tel Aviv and Jaffa, spent the war living in Gaza. And it's interesting that you pointed to media in 2014, because that was really the year that the coverage of the discussion of Palestine shifted. We were able to report things from Gaza City in terms of the Palestinian experience and its third Gaza war with this complete onslaught, and what it was that people were, why people were determined to continue to fight if they thought it was going to end the blockade and the siege, and to tell those stories in an unvarnished way in the mainstream U.S. press that you'd have trouble expressing in the left-wing and progressive press in 2008. That same stuff. So there was a shift that went on. Yeah, I mean, the scene with the highway, it's interesting because it's Highway 443. It is the alternate route between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem that cuts right through the West Bank. Now, it also connects with all the villages with nearby Ramallah, and there have actually been even court cases at Israel's own Supreme Court that have been won saying that Palestinians with Palestinian-plated cars should be allowed to, within a Palestinian area, drive on this road. Despite the law, the checkpoint is still fully in place, and while in theory a Palestinian car can drive on this road, in practice, they never are. And so it is a sign of the enforced segregation for the continuity and flow of the Israeli public and Israeli territory. And so it's unique because it's not like a settler road that's kind of out connecting two settlements in the northern West Bank that, you know, is a way of avoiding Nablus or whatever. This is a road that connects two of Israel's most important cities, and it cuts right through the heart of the West Bank, and it is militarily segregated. And it is, in that sense, a expression of the kind of permanence of the Israeli system as it currently exists, and Israel's intention to not have it as an indefinite temporary system, but as a structurally permanent one.
Could you tell me a bit more about this shift that you think happened in terms of coverage? Do you feel that's part of like a bigger ongoing trend?
Yeah, I mean, there were several factors that I think went into it. Firstly, with the plethora of media that's out there, the debate around Israel has been forced open more. Organizations like Electronic Intifada have been very effective in using new mediums to compete with the kind of breadth and determination of a lot of the pro-Israel organizations that lobby the media. And they've been able to put out a Palestinian perspective within the West. And, you know, and activist groups have done this increasingly so. But also, in Gaza, during the war, you had every major journalist from every major network all getting bombed together, seeing that for themselves that there's nowhere to run. And everyone's fixer has family that they, you know, they wonder whether their family are going to survive the night while they're out helping you get onto a rooftop to see what's going on. So, I mean, everyone felt the war. And because in terms of political shifts, the certain amount of daylight or frustration that people in Washington were hearing because of the frustration of the Obama administration started to ripple through when their correspondents in the Middle East said, hey, this is going on. They just bombed a UN school. You know, we saw the rubble. We saw where the missiles came from. We saw the family screaming. we can see clearly how this process is not only happening and how it's being enabled, but the political cynicism of it. And when that all came around and broke through into the 24-hour news cycle, there was a certain reality that you couldn't stop looking at. And we're not talking opinion. We're talking about a reporting of what the experience of living under an Israeli war in a place that is besieged and occupied. It was astonishing to actually be able to, for the first time, break through and tell in the U.S. mainstream press. Yeah, I think the way that people see that war is fundamentally different than the way that they see other Israeli wars, and that was a breaking point for many people, is because of that reality of what changed and what we were allowed to see of the war.
There's another scene in the movie, which actually isn't in Palestine, but it's at a refugee camp where you're talking to someone who is basically talking about how they think all journalists are liars.
Oh, yeah, the guy was telling me to go fuck a donkey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you navigate that kind of resistance where people very reasonably have a mistrust of journalists?
I mean, you try to understand it, and it's completely understandable. If you're living in a refugee, and he was a Kurdish refugee in the camps on the Turkish side of the border, just overwatching Kobani as the battle for Kobani raged, he could step out of his tent into a muddied ground where he had absolutely nothing, and look a few kilometers away and watch the billows of smoke from what is his village being pummeled in a battle that no one was doing anything about except the Kurds were fighting on their own. And his frustration was that no matter who he told his story to, and you see this all the time, and no matter how many times he went through it, and no matter what he said or what anyone around him said, his situation got worse. For him, what's the point in telling? People tell their stories because they hope that when people hear their story, people take action and do something about their lives. And when your only experience is other people coming, hearing what you have to say, but nothing changing, it's an incredibly frustrating experience.
So you mentioned Kobani in your answer. I wanted to ask about what you think is being undercovered by a mainstream press in the Middle East right now.
Well, I mean, the Syrian Kurdish struggle is one of those things that's very difficult to cover. Getting in to Rojava is a very difficult process, especially since the Kurdistan Regional Government in northern Iraq has closed their access points from Iraq to the Kurds there. So there has been a lot written on it. The Kurdish story, I think the Kurdish story that is more undercovered is the situation in southeast Turkey. And last year in March, I was in southeast Turkey in Diyarbakir. And I was the first foreign journalist into Cezre after the Turks had obliterated it with tank shelling, to a way that actually looked like a lot of streets I saw in Gaza City during the war. And what you have is the government engaged in a total Israeli occupation style of repression accelerated by a counterinsurgency war being fought in the Kurdish cities across the southeast. And we don't talk about that. And the story that I wrote, we went into Cezre, we saw where people had been blown up, where families were huddling in basements and they had been incinerated. And the connection with Syria is that people in southeast Turkey look at the YPG and they think, well, the YPG has been successful in carving out territory where Kurds can decide for themselves, regardless of the bitter conditions they face around them. That's going to be our only response to Turkey, a country that doesn't want to actually negotiate a federalized system or any sense of Kurdish self-determination. And so, I mean, that story in the mess of everything is one that, increasingly gets lost. It's also because it's hard to access. I mean, so we saw what went on in Cezre, then we went and talked to the PKK behind their barricades in Nusaybin, which is another city on the Syrian border. But talking to the people on the front lines of a guerrilla urban insurgency is a very difficult process to mass cover anyway. However, because of the news of Syria, which is completely justifiable, and the horror that's happening there, because of Erdogan's own maneuvering in Ankara, there are so many other monumentously politically consequential places and hotspots surrounding everything that's happening in the southeast, that story gets lost in the blaze of fire that surrounds it.